This is very important. Is this going to pick up background noise? Like if they yell?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay, good. I've been coached by someone who speaks internationally to inform y'all that if the podium catches fire today, that there's a fire exit here and here, right? That's number one. Number two, show of hands, who here has seen Stan Woodward's It's Grits documentary? Good. Okay, John, you asked for it. You think Pig Lips was fun. Watch this. Okay, everybody take a big breath. Stand up, please. Why are we here? We want to make a difference, which everyone has said from the beginning, and this is how you do it South Carolina style. John has family from South Carolina. In fact, right near where my mill is. In fact, one of the growers knows his family over in Orangeburg. Are you ready? We're going to do a little cheer. Those of you who have seen Stan Woodward's work know exactly what I'm talking about. Those who haven't, everybody clear their throats right now. You ready? All right. Here you go. This is going to work. Give me a G.
G.
Give me an R.
R.
Give me an I.
I.
Give me a T.
T.
What's that spell?
Grits.
What do you love?
Grits.
Tell it again.
Grits.
Yeah. All right. Okay, John, that's it. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm reminded of my friend over here who said he wanted to rewrite his speech. I know exactly what you're talking about. All right, I have one thing to add here real quickly, and this is going to be bumpy and it's going to go really fast because I do have ponderous, important things to say today.
You don't have to go fast. You got time.
You got time?
As long as we
okay.
Get you in a decent amount of time, roll.
At 7 tonight if you want to shoot me? No. Okay. I have a definition I think a lot of you here will appreciate, and I didn't think of it till I was sitting here this morning, but I remember it. I've been in the South a long time. And I think it's really important to this to say this. This is a farm-to-table themed event. And farmers, how do you define an old-time Southern farmer? It's not gender-specific. But if you look in the field, it can be men or women, but the ones that are really old-time farmers are the ones that remember to turn their corncob pipe upside down when it starts to rain. Okay? Nobody comments on what's in the pipe, just they turn it over. All right? I had to say that. I don't know why. Okay. Define grits. Well, it's just typical of the South. The South has produced a lot of corn, and of course, a lot of Southerners are accused of liking corn in any form. On the cob, by the glass, and most any other way. And grits is very much like that. It's a part of corn. End quote. I didn't say quote. Senator Strom Thurmond quoted in It's Grits, Stan Woodward documentary, 1970. I am an early 60s vintage La Jolla, California surfer, which bestows no Southern roots upon me whatsoever and permanently disqualifies me from any claim to understand the place which I live, which is Charleston, South Carolina, or any other place Southern. Faulkner would roll over in his grave to realize the culture I came from contributed surf's up and gnarly dude to the American vernacular. To get to the immediate point, I need to confess, after milling and processing by hand over 100,000 pounds of corn, sending John hundreds of emails to keep him up on what's going on, like I understand it, right? And this 150,000 pounds is the best mill corn I could find and grow. After growing and preserving many varieties of heirloom corn and grains, after cooking tons of grits in every way imaginable, and after studying historic texts and interviewing millers, farmers, horticulturists, master gardeners, historians, and quizzing Carolina and Georgia families, especially the older ones, both black, white, red, yellow, you name it, about their preference for and their definitions of grits, after all this process, I find I know absolutely nothing about grits, while possibly being the most informed person on the planet Earth about the culture and cookery of grits. Life Story Gone Grits Crazy is a title invented by a person other than myself, which is why I didn't send this to you last month, that epitomizes the reason for us all to take a few intellectual steps sideways out of the box to view the laser light show of Southern wit and humor that is John T. Edge. From that, we will assume two ideas. John T. Edge wrote the title, and as usual, he cut to the chase at the top and reduced what I put up in 40 pages to 5 words. Life Story Gone Grits Crazy. So even though I've admitted my California shortcomings and should be totally excused from all practical matters Southern, I confess I hold dear the vivid panorama of historic Southern culture painted in words and foods by my mother, who is a Southerner, in her heart and at her stove. I was surprised and confused, just like when John ate the piglets last night. The first time my California buddies ran screaming out of our house at whiffs of seductive cooking aromas emanating from my mother's kitchen when she cooked Southern. Because my mother was a Southerner, I was raised Southern at the supper table with the icons of Southern cooking. Fried chicken, fried fish, cornbread, grits, green sausage, country ham, biscuits, every fresh vegetable and fruit imaginable right from the garden, and at least 2 desserts at every meal, including breakfast. Southern food was natural in our household. Quote, "Grits, Nothing More Than Ground Corn," by John Martin Taylor, Hop and John's Low Country Cooking. My friends never understood that. The only Southern food my surfing buddies would eat was fried chicken and any of my mother's desserts, of course, especially our spring Sunday supper ritual of cat's heads biscuits, fresh picked strawberries with whipped cream and honey. My buddies thought it was some kind of weird shortcake. Who knows? In reflections on the lads of my youth and their fear of Southern food, I often wonder what foods they enjoy now. It is perfect justice that half a century later, I know I can immerse myself in any Charleston soul food restaurant and reminisce while my buddies are sitting in San Diego going to McDonald's to get grits 24 hours a day. Because that's the only place they're served, to my knowledge. Quote, "We saw several plats of ground cleared by the Indians, compassed round by great timber trees, and so keep the sun from their cornfields very much." This is important. "Yet we saw as large corn stalks or bigger as anywhere else." William Hilton, English exploratory party out of Charlestown, Romaine, upon first contact with Edisto Island natives who knew Spanish and rifles and were not terribly happy to see him. This is in 1664. My mother grew up during the Great Depression, lived in Augusta, Georgia, and summered on Edisto Island just south of Charleston, South Carolina. Life on Edisto is such that the church she attended in the 1930s has not changed in any detail to this day. Our pilgrimage to her church is annual and is akin to time travel. Everything in view from the pews, including the verdant brilliance of Carolina wilderness morning sunlight streaming through sagging antique glass panes, defies the arrival of the 19th century. My mother tells me her experiences on Edisto during the Depression reflect the spirit of preservation characterized in the architecture and surrounding of her church. According to her, not much that matters in life on Edisto has changed from the 18th century. More important, because those who know my mom well admire her skill and touches of soul in the kitchen, my mother says her talent for cooking developed from sharing recipes and suppers with Edisto locals, both black and white, during the Depression. Quote, "White corn's for people, yellers for critters," end quote. My buddy Phil Pettis, who I've known for almost 20 years now, started saying this for some idiotic reason in 1995. He can't remember to this day, he's in Charleston at Anson Restaurant, but he can't remember to this day where he first heard this. I'm sure someone wrote it and or has documented where it came from, but he says it all the time, and he's from Fort Mill, South Carolina. My mother's definition of scratch cooking is founded on the foodways of Edisto Island and begins with the caveat that good Southern cooks should grow their ingredients. She says everyone on Edisto grew corn and wheat by economic necessity or out of loyalty to family tradition. My mother insists that the best sweet and mill corn are the same corn, just harvested earlier for sweet. The best corn was invariably grown Indian style with beans, squash, which was traditional on all local plantations and farms for kitchen garden corn. Most locals preferred white corn, but occasionally would mix some yellow field corn in with their white grits. All Edisto locals held that yellow corn was exclusively and indeed for critters. She says the Edisto Country Store of the 1930s would mill a family's corn to grits and meal in small batches to order, along with biscuit flour, rice, and coffee. She says locals called what they carried home from the mill fresh grist, as in fresh produce. Edisto locals of the time handled fresh grist and produce with the same preservation techniques because both were regarded as equally perishable. My mother says everyone on Edisto milled just enough grain to last for 1 week, no more. No one on Edisto had the slightest notion of the term shelf-stable that defines the style of mill goods in the last century. There is no legal mill on Edisto today. The nearest legal mill is almost 80 miles round trip and is primarily a feed mill. There were 40 mills per county in the Carolinas and Georgia before the Civil War. To put this in perspective, the area I'm speaking of represents 180 counties. You can do the math. By the way, Karen, John blessed those things since he's so much a time at on Edisto Island, right? Quote, explain the difference between hominy, grist, and grits. Did I say that right? Hominy, grist, and grits. This is something that Ashley Cooper wrote in 1960. He was a columnist in Charleston, South Carolina. The handbook you probably know, those of you in the publishing industry, it's called Top Secret Handbook on How a Columnist for a Southern Newspaper Can Generate Mail. Everyone familiar with that? Okay. Kathleen Purvis is over saying, yes, Bible. This is courtesy of Ann Berger in Charleston, but Kathleen's mentioned it before too. This is guaranteed, according to Ann Berger, 500 letters from your readers. Last time she did it. Wow. Celeste Ford Albers, whose family has farmed in Charleston, South Carolina for over 200 years, says her grandfather milled to order fresh grits, biscuit flour, rice, and coffee at his country store before World War II. Celeste says her grandfather referred to what came out of the mill as hominy grist if it was winnowed to separate bran only. Grits if the grist was sifted to separate big pieces of ground corn from the cornmeal. Hominy if the grits were cooked. And hominy grist, isn't this great? If what was cooked and served was every part of the ground corn except the bran. Okay. I can't even say it. No wonder no one understands it. Quote, by the time, quote, by the by came their women, bringing their pots to boil a kind of thickening which they pound and make food of. This from a letter from one of Captain Joseph West's Charlestown settlement group describing first contact with the Bohicket tribe at what is now Rockville, South Carolina. This contact was on the banks of Bohicket Creek. The thickening was hominy. It's what the Indians called it. Cooked grits, the first food of Charleston settlement, and this was in 1670. Celeste Albers and her husband George Shrimp, and Donna Florio, who's here, knows George very well from back in the days when she worked in Charleston. Shrimp and farm on Wadmalaw Island just south of Charleston, South Carolina, near Rockville. They are proud of the fact that William Hilton, Robert Sanford, and Joseph West dropped anchor in 1664, 66, and 70, respectively. And that's just a quarter of a mile from where their farm is now. The Albers family raised antebellum corn, biscuit wheat, and heirloom vegetables on Alabama Field. By the way, Alabama Field's named after a car wreck. It's not anything significant in history, which I was really disappointed to find out. You know, somebody came around the curve from Alabama. Yeah. Now it's Alabama Field, and that was back in the 30s. Yeah. Go figure, nothing much happens out there, right? That's big doings. Decades of excitement. Anyhow, Alabama Field is known and has been known for centuries as sweet ground. At Captain West's first contact, the field displayed great shell mounds, oyster shell mounds, by the way, created by oyster-eating natives guarding crops because the Edisto and Bohicket always knew it as sweet ground, too. It is very likely that Captain West marched across Alabama Field with his Kiowa guides in the spring of 1670 to find the first English settlement site of what is now known as Charlestown Landing. Quote, do you think, and this is where our last speaker could have helped me out so much, why didn't I meet you before? Quote, do you think Rockville is named after the Algonquin word for the cook grits, Rockahominy? End quote. This is a question I asked over 50 families who told me, in no impolite terms, a lot of different bad words I can't say here, to go away. They said no. And I spent a lot of time chasing this down, thinking it might be. So much for etymology. On a serious note, the Albers family leases their farm. In May this year, surveyors appeared unannounced on one of their best fields to mark the land for development. That's why we're here. Quote, to the southerner, grits are a matter of loyalty. This is from the World Grits Festival, Y2 Grits brochure, St. George, South Carolina, 2000. To the southerner, grits are a matter of loyalty. In 2001, Burbage's small family store is still open at its original location on Broad Street in downtown Charleston, providing grocery goods, including homemade sausages and custom butchering. And nobody can repeat this, but they will take down anything you shoot. It's a good place. You want, I don't care what it is, they'll fix it. I see everything going out the back door there, but it's against the law. Right? Countless Charlestonians reminisce about the old man Burbage, who as late as 1930s would haul his mill by trailer to the old equestrian parade field at the Charleston Peninsula Armory on Saturday mornings. They say he hooked the mill up to the rear tee of his model, the rear axle of his Model T, and ground corn and biscuit wheat for all comers. According to my hero, John Martin Taylor, who I put down in here as an internationally respected cultural historian and Charleston writer like we don't know who he is. Okay, everyone in Charleston had a country plot, as he calls it, of corn and biscuit wheat. John, unfortunately, did not immediately tell me that many of these families, as late as the early 1960s, still had their own special hand selects of corn and wheat seed. These seeds had been passed on to each new generation for centuries. In my now 7-year search for exceptionally flavored milk corn, I have learned the hard way that this tradition of seedsmanship in the Carolinas and Georgia is threatened with extinction. The looming process of widespread cultural loss has interrupted my life, because not what I do for a living, drawn me inexorably toward the preservation of 18th and 19th century Carolina and Georgia agricultural heritage. I now know with certainty that family seeds and the seedsmanship involved in preserving them are central to the regional identity of Carolina and Georgia foodways, period. Quote, we've taken a survey here, not gonna believe this, we've taken a survey here asking whether grits cooked on the coast in local coastal water makes better grits than the same grits cooked in upstate water. 60% of the respondents say they know about this and agree that coastal water makes better grits. These are black, white, yellow, green people, professionals. This is the entire staff of Palmetto Richland Memorial Hospital in Columbia, South Carolina. Survey taken in October by Dr. Susan Ryan. I could not believe they brought this to me. Right? Mr. and Mrs. Robert E. Lee live in Irmo, just outside of Columbia, South Carolina, and yes, he is a relation. Yeah. There is no doubt they are genuine Southerners because they know the difference between store-bought and fresh grits, and their pepper vinegar holds a place of supremacy on the supper table. right? They also possess a lovely, and I'm talking pepper vinegar, it's not Tabasco, it's not Texas Pea, they make it, right? They also possess a lovely old painting of a Carolina overshot waterwheel toll mill with what appears to be 10-foot tall letters on the side in white paint that says, fresh grits. It's an oil, it's real, it's old. I thought that was so great. Quote, in 1994, we realized that old-fashioned stone mill grits, where the grits are milled coarse, were gaining in popularity in restaurants outside the South. So we decided to get out our old stone milling equipment and crank it up. Now we slow cook our stone ground grits as part of our milling museum tour and have an annual grits cook-off. We even sell old-fashioned grits in Las Vegas. This quote from Bill Allen, president, Allen Brothers Milling, Columbia, South Carolina, 2001. Mr. and Mrs. Lee remember the aromas of fresh milk corn at their local toll mill as children in Union, South Carolina, and Shelby, North Carolina, respectively. The Lees pursue documentation of their sizable family history and its relationship to mainstream Southern history. Because of this, they are aware of the significance of living in the center of the 19th century Carolina mill corn belt and its related 19th century milling industry. They struggle not to take for granted the giant flashing red neon letters raised on 200-foot tall antique grain elevators in the center of their state capital city. Those letters spell A-D-L-U-H as in Adlu Grits, to mark the location of the last operating gravity-fed commercial grain mill in America. The mill is within spitting distance of the South Carolina state capital. Adlu is the contemporary grits brand name for Allen Brothers Milling Company, which was founded in 1820 in Peachland, North Carolina. The Lees are aware that the Bokehart family farm is near their house, the Lees house, and that the Bokehart farms supplies milk corn to Allen Brothers Milling. The Lees say, this is great, the Lees say Mr. Bokehart won first place for white seed corn at the South Carolina State Agricultural Fair this year. Well, that was neat. Quote, many South Carolinians can remember the way old-fashioned hominy looked, full of golden flecks, cooked several hours to a somewhat stiff consistency. Charleston News and Courier, 1957. Dr. David Bradshaw is a seedsman with an exceptional view of his responsibility as a horticulturist. He is professor of horticulture at Clemson University, consulting horticulturist to the South Carolina Botanical Gardens. See why those emails to John are so long? Can't even get this guy's title down. And curator of the heirloom vegetable display garden at the 1716 Huguenot Farmhouse. Up there in Clemson. He also provides his heirloom vegetable and grain seed to the public through seed banking efforts at South Carolina Foundation Seed. He dedicates much of his career to the restoration and preservation of cultural heritage of Carolina and Georgia heirloom vegetables and grains by seeking out farmers and master gardeners who have no one to pass their seeds to upon retirement. His work began in the 1970s with the realization that many important family seeds were being lost due to the abandonment of Carolina and Georgia family farms for development. David's career choice was prescient in that his area near Greenville, South Carolina, and Mr. Lee's area around Columbia, South Carolina, ranked highest in America for farm acreage lost to development. David Bradshaw grows heirloom milk corn and hand mills grits and cornmeal for his family. David believes the best heirloom sweet corn also makes the best milk corn, or more appropriately in historic context, the best milk corn harvested early is fabulous sweet corn. His belief is supported by the fact that he and his family have over 20 years' experience in comparative heirloom cookery. Heirloom corn cookery, excuse me. He remembers the comfort and excitement he felt as a child when his family brought their corn to their local toll mill in upstate Carolina. David recalls the sounds, aromas, and feel of warm, fresh corn grist spilling over his hands at the sifter chute on cold winter mornings at the mill. I want to emphasize this point. David doesn't have to recall what old-fashioned cooked grits are because he makes hominy for his family from scratch using corn from his own family's antebellum history that's centuries old. He grinds it fresh by hand and prepares it, and he's been doing so since 1971, which is one of the things that got me into this. Quote, there was a mill every 8 miles because 4 miles out and back by foot was all a farmer could manage and still do his daily chores. What happened was that the miller became central to each community because he had to work and listen at the same time. I can, like, grind grits and email John still. Right? Politics and the related community food events that were held at the mill. The mill was where everyone gathered. This contributed to the popularity of region and the regional identity of community bogs and stews, and also the evolution of the miller as the community leader. Of course, the fact that most millers were distillers too helped in boosting community spirit in more than one way. This is also why so many folks are loyal to their mill brand today, but I don't think they're conscious of it anymore. This quote by Robert Hagee, president, Meadows Mills, North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, this year. What is grits? No one agrees. Robert Hagee, who just this quote came from, is president of the largest manufacturer of stone milling equipment in the Americas. If anybody's supposed to know, he should. His family has been in the business since 1870, so one would assume his definition of grits should be gospel, but he immediately qualifies every specific definition and annoyingly follows it with specific exceptions. He's a genius, by the way. Robert Hagee's definition of grits: 100% endosperm, that's the hard part of the corn kernel, particles sized from 1/12, oh boy, to 1/16 of an inch. It's not helpful that the professional milling industry designates 16 official grinds, called cuts in the industry, of milled corn with names no layperson ever wants to hear. Mr. Hagee is quick to point out that the Seminole Nation produces the largest commercial grits in America to his knowledge, which average about 1/10 of an inch in particle size. And there is yet another definition of grits by one of the South's most respected and successful small millers. Joe Lindley, president of Lindley Mills in Graham, North Carolina, says old-fashioned style grits range from 1/10 to 1/26 of an inch particle size and not necessarily all endosperm. Joe Lindley's family has been milling grits on the same site since the middle of the 18th century, but they took a 100-year hiatus to join the medical profession from 1875 to 1975. One would, and they still remembered how to do it. He went right back to work. He's now the biggest small miller in the South, right? Don't you love it? Yeah. One would think that his family definition of grits would also be gospel, but guess what? Joe is quick to point out that the definition of his grits is his alone and not what he calls standard. No one has one. One thing is certain. Joe's mill is state-of-the-art, and he can produce any shape of grits possible, including something he's calling corn rice. It's a brand new world of laser cutters and laser separators out there in the contemporary milling business, let me tell you. I expect to see alphabet grits soon. Quote, buttered kitty litter. My favorite quote of all. Guess who? Bette Midler, and she didn't have a writer to do this. She thought of this herself. Bette Midler quoted her Charleston concert reported in the Charleston Post and Courier in 1994. She did, however, love the grits. Quote, my father is 90 years old, and he loves Quaker grits. William Barr from a very old Charleston family, 1999. Quaker, John's going to love this. Quaker, judged by volume alone, is the only producer of grits in America. That's by volume. Almost 70 million pounds a year. No company is anywhere near them in production, the disparity being something on the order of 50 million pounds to the next highest producer. The interesting point about all this dry numeric data is that I hear constantly that anyone who loves grits doesn't care for Quaker grits all that much. But guess what? Comparatively, no one's buying anything else. Quaker actually used to do a stone ground yellow grit that's very, very good. I don't know if they still do it. I don't see it in Charleston anymore. And I haven't seen it in Columbia either, for that matter. So I don't know whether they're still putting it out. So I'm not dunning Quaker here, because who's going to fight the big guys? They're liable to stomp on me, right? Quaker grits, this is right up your alley, isn't it? Yeah. Quaker grits are small and cook immediately to mush, which I used to enjoy after a night of college-era drinking. I saw some of that today. Right? After I cleared the dinosaurs out of the parking lot, John, it was that long ago, I'd stumbled into the Apple House near Woman's College, it was Woman's College then, in Greensboro, North Carolina. I'd slur out my order and eventually realize I was staring at and possibly drooling into a plate of eggs, sausage, patty sausage, tomato slices, they're always unripe, and Quaker instant grits. I'd load the grits with tons of pepper sauce. This is how you do it, by the way. To reassure myself there was indeed something to eat there. Right? Then I'd shake tons of black pepper over the grits so I could differentiate them from the white plate they were sitting on. And then stir in lots and lots of butter so that the culinary result was pepper-flavored butter something. Hey, Robert, you ever serve that in your place? I learned this method of enjoying Quaker grits from North Carolinians that went to Chapel Hill. Go figure. They were my friends. I don't think they were lying to me. I was watching them eat this if I could see them. It was kind of, yeah. I still enjoy Quaker grits this way occasionally with underripe tomatoes to relive or relieve the memories without the alcohol. For general information, if anyone here is strong enough to party in this fashion, this style of grits cookery is a surefire method to cover up a bad hangover with indigestion. I had a second idea here that goes with this is on a more serious note. After watching its grits and seeing peanut butter stirred into them and chow chow and God knows what else. And if you haven't seen this, you've got to get it. You got to see it. It's great. But on a more serious note, I didn't appreciate my primordial urge to mix chilies with ground corn until I grew up. Been studying Native American foodways for a while now. I don't know much about them, really, but that's another story. But chilies and grits, that's big in California because all my people that order them out there, the big coarse grits, they're doing it to make chili grits. Fun, huh? Quote, one buys grits, cooks it, and the result is hominy. One more time. One buys grits, cooks it, and the result is hominy. Donna Florio's an expert on this one. This is by Elizabeth Verner Hamilton, forward to the 1976 printing of 200 Years of Charleston Cooking. If it is not totally clear that this presentation is Charleston-centric, I will now jump out of that Charleston closet and get in your face. In other words, from here on, you're unfortunate souls. God bless you. I state only my opinions and perspective, nothing else. Charleston, South Carolina is the only... Damon, you're not going to like this. Charleston, South Carolina is the only place in the world where you can be served what is generally appreciated as grits. Although you can find mush and seafood anywhere in the world and could before the English settled Charleston, only in Charleston can you be served what was there before European settlement as a contemporary foodway. That foodway is called precisely shrimp and hominy. Charleston hominy has nothing to do with wood ash cookery and never did. Wood ash cookery is the lie thing, right? That's okay. No one likes it because of the depression they had to eat it. Okay. No. Charleston hominy has never had anything to do with wood ash cookery. It is my belief that Native American, and note that this includes all the Americas, Native American cookery was and is far more complex than its old world counterparts. There were and are literally thousands of distinct methods, treatments, and preparations for corn alone. And unfortunately, there is no documentation for the myriad specific varietals of corn, and we go back to the seeds all the time to look at this, grown by Native Americans of Carolina Territory or for their uses and recipes. Betty Fussell, thank you, John, mentions in the story of corn, her book, that a contemporary horticultural survey of a very small area around Mexico City turned up over 300 different varietals of corn, and I believe this is within the last 6 years. 300 varietals of corn in a small area, I think it was within 5 acres. I believe the available varietals of corn, their sacred meaning and recipes, were just as prolific in Carolina before first contact. There is general agreement within the historic horticulture community that the prevalent Native American corns grown in Carolina Territory before European first contact were dense. Dent corn is soft and can be milled by hand easily from its dried state, which eliminates the need for wood ash treatment. Quote, in the old days, everyone planted white corn because it was a delicacy. Yellow was for Yankees. These days, yellow corn is associated with the hybrid revolution. It's hard to get good corn these days. Ray Wheeler, owner, Atkinson's Mills, Selma, North Carolina, 1999 and 2001. Hominy is cooked grits. that's made from white corn because hominy in Charleston terms reflects the Bohicket and Kiowa culture of offering sacred elements to strangers as a signal of peace. In Native American culture, white corn is the most sacred and is pivotal in stories of the creation of the world. Hominy in contemporary Charleston is a cultural statement with precise historic meaning, then. To prove the meaning, consider this. England is not world-renowned as the seat of hospitality. Charleston is. In Charleston, despite what was done to wipe out Native culture in the 18th century, the culture of the Bohicket and Kiowa lives in language, cookery, and deed when hominy is served at any place in Charleston, in any context, at any time. Hominy is the Charleston signal of peace and welcome. Here's something on the lighter side. Quote, grits ain't just for breakfast anymore, end quote. Well, with over 300 chefs I talk to regularly for the last 2 years. Every one of them says that a lot. Where did the notion that grits are just for breakfast come from? I'm not sure that Charlestonians are aware of the traditional time context rule for grits for breakfast only. I have not encountered any significant information about it in reading, but I have certainly enjoyed many times a shrimp and hominy traditional Charleston breakfast at midnight at social events around town and at many hunt breakfasts at 1 in the afternoon. I have been told that the term breakfast in Charleston speak refers to hunt breakfast. In Charleston, anytime you return from any hunt, in reality or symbolically, you may have breakfast. I know well some older Charlestonians, and I don't limit this to gentlemen, who consider a formal ball a hunt. As a 15-year veteran of the Middleton Hounds, I can assure you this is true. To make this clear, in Charleston, grits were never just for breakfast in the contemporary sense. The general perception that grits are for breakfast only resulted from a mistranslation of Charleston culture. Back to the serious matters. I'll repeat my point because it's very important by starting with this quote. Quote, is it a bow or a sifter? This is a traditional Cherokee greeting upon the birth of a new child. The Cherokee people, Thomas E. Mails. I am influenced and stand in awe of any society that defines humanity strictly in terms of a plant, which is the holistic reality for most Native Americans in their relationship with their mother corn. Corn fed in the South takes on new meaning in this context. In the Native American and Charleston perspective, hominy is open-handed food that is the result of no treatment other than simple cookery. But as I said earlier, it's a signal also. Water and ground corn, a Native American ritual of food, of peace, involving two of their most precious elements in their purest form. The connections here are staggering. You know, it was a joke at the beginning of this thing. Why would anybody in upstate South Carolina still care about water in their grits? But in this context, it makes big sense. And why does Robert Stelling insist that grits cooked with anything else but water ain't grits? There's a reason for that. Here's the quote that makes sense even today. Half century old. An inexpensive, simple, and thoroughly digestible food, hominy should be made popular throughout the world. Given enough of it, the inhabitants of planet Earth would have nothing to fight about. A man full of hominy is a man of peace. The News and Courier, Charleston, South Carolina, 1952. In 2001, we're at war. Given recent events, I want to make certain we understand that comfort food, the food of peace, has taken on a brand new meaning. And from my perspective, its civilized roots live in Charleston. Quote, on every plantation before the Civil War, there was a grist mill for general use, but most of the grinding of corn was done by small grinding mills, which were portable and which the Negroes moved from house to house, one mill being allowed for every 5 families. From these, both grits and flour were made, the flour consisting of the eye of the corn and the grits, the remainder of the grain. This quote by Duncan Clinch Hayward, seed from Madagascar, Charleston, South Carolina, 1937. Quote, my best friend and I grew up out here in Orangeburg, South Carolina, working on the same farm. We made some real good corn, the grain, not liquor. My friend has been a minister in South Africa now for the last 20 years. We both know corn very well, but he says Africa has the best corn in the world. This from Mr. Langley M. Schull, retired farmer, Orangeburg, South Carolina. He knows your relatives. The Turks, by plundering Cornwallis, Spanish, and Portuguese treasure ships, introduced corn to northern Africa and Italy around 1500. The Portuguese and Spanish took care of every place else at that same time, including introducing corn to the slave colonies of West Africa as a staple. I have to constantly remind myself that the English, French, Dutch, Portuguese, Italian, Chinese, and Africans were cooking corn at least 150 years before Charleston was settled. So I have to be clear that grits cookeries did not originate in Charleston by European contact. I'm reminded of a dialogue in John T. Edge's Southern Belly, where John asks a North Carolina Native American why fry bread isn't on her restaurant menu. John, in this instance, from my view anyhow, is picking a foodway icon from the 19th century, but the Native American he's speaking to isn't buying any of it. She replies that the squash, beans, greens, and corn on her menu are native foods, and her people have been cooking them for thousands of years. The point in calling attention to this dialogue is that although the culture of the Bohicket and Kiowa shows through in Charleston hominy today, their foodways went to Europe, Asia, and Africa, were changed by those cultures, and returned with Captain Joseph and his merry band of Brits in 1670. It is safe to assume that in many instances, Native American foodways were entirely wiped out by assimilation in Africa and Europe before Charleston settlement due to Eurocentricity. And Karen, I hope this is right. Afrocentricity? I don't know. It sounds like a good word, doesn't it? All right. To illustrate this point, consider that Karen Hess has brilliantly documented Charleston's African rice culture and noted the strength of their foodways in the failed attempt in Charleston to emulate Sea Island rice horticulture of Venice, Italy. I have often wondered how the interaction worked with white, black, and red indentured servants. Most of the original Africans in Charleston were cowboys, right? I love to find that out. White, black, and red indentured servants and well-paid Italian canal engineers from Venice, Italy, on the struggling Charleston-area rice farms in the time around 1680. Did the Italians, English, and Africans want to make corn mush and the native slaves not allow it? In so many first contacts account, Native Americans immediately provided their cookery and refused that of their visitors. No one knows, but a creative point remains. Urban gardening traditions and many other cultural elements of Venice, Italy, and Charleston are eerily similar, and there is a lingering influence of what seems to be cucina veneto in many old Charleston recipes. One would expect this in any port culture, but Jim Fitch, curator of the Carolina Gold Rice Museum in Georgetown, South Carolina, gave me an antique olive oil amphora from an old Charleston, South Carolina plantation in 1998. That same afternoon, he spent about 3 hours regaling us, no end, on the Italian and particularly cucina veneto influences in Charleston foodways. Along those lines, my experience working beside 94-year-old African-American cook in Charleston convinces me that Africans and Italians shared many foodways in early Charleston. The cook's name was Alma Gaillard. Her mother was a slave cook, and she was raised on John's Island just across the Ashley River from Charleston. Alma would make us what she called in Gullah, which is the Creole language of the Sea Islands there in Charleston, if you don't know. She'd make us what she called reezy peasy. I thought at the time, and still think for that matter, that the gullah for this dish, Alma insisted, could only be made from fresh field peas, was very like the cucina veneto St. Mark's feast dish of reezy peasy. It is my experience with wonderful Charleston cooks like Alma that leads me to make the leap that Charleston hominy evolved to what is now a tradition of preparing it with dairy, just as corn mush is prepared with traditional white corn and dairy in Venice, Italy. Robert, I apologize, but I hope this adds some fuel to the dairy, no dairy controversial fires and underscores how old world and new world culinary traditions intertwined in Charleston cookery. There is a Native American foodway, by the way, that supports this in some sense. Pounded wild nut creams were mixed with hominy, as were thousands of other ingredients for that matter, and I can become silly with this foodway and have Native Americans adding duck eggs to this to make Native American spoon bread. But it doesn't really get all that silly because I've seen stuff in the Cherokees that says that happened. Quote, during the Civil War, the house mill, one of Carolina's oldest, provided cornmeal and grits by donkey to both Confederate and Yankee troops at Bentonville, North Carolina. That is, until the Yankees shot the donkey for meat. Guess whose side the Mill family fought on? This is from Roger Mortensen, President, House of Autry, Newton Grove, North Carolina, curator of House Mill and Autry Brothers Milling Histories. The House Mill was the second oldest mill established in Carolina Territory. And just as a tragic note, around 1950, the original House Mill building was converted into a roller skating rink. Sherman destroyed most artisan community mills in the Carolinas and Georgia at the end of the Civil War, and the revolution for quantity milling occurred immediately thereafter. The disappearance of artisan mills was immediate and permanent, but the creeping erosion of the small family farm was difficult to perceive until the Great Depression. The South has retained much of its agricultural heritage out of necessity, nonetheless. Most small farmers in the South could not afford to acquire technological advances available in farming well into the 20th century. Quote, years ago we had better corn. This is from Michael Keller, owner of Union Grove Milling Company, Union Grove, North Carolina. Quote, good corn's getting tight. Joe Lindley, Lindley Mills, Graham, North Carolina. Quote, the saying goes, if you find a spring in the wilderness, there's a still nearby. Quote, I can't talk about it on this phone, Glenn. That's exactly how Robert Hagee sounds. I tried it out. He's president of Meadows Mills in North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, international capital of white liquor. Prohibition was a stroke of divine coincidence that grew with the Depression and unintentionally acted as insurance for the Southern heirloom seed corn preservation and its farming. Best in large industries in the history of the world, white liquor. White liquor begat a Depression-era artisan milling phenomenon and a hand-select seed preservation effort of tremendous scope. All the terms are dramatic. The revenue agents watched for purchases at the seed companies, so bootleggers hand-selected their family corn and missed the hybrid corn revolution in the South. Revenue agents watched the surviving Southern toll mills for unsold milled corn, so bootleggers moved small artisan mills into the woods. A 1,000-gallon groundhog still needs about 300 pounds of fresh ground cornmeal to start up. Moonshine has always been a large industry, but we have not found a way to document it well. Even Betty Fussell glossed over it for obvious reasons in The Story of Corn. Speaking of which, she didn't do much on grits either, but we have John Martin Taylor and Bill Neal for popular source material. I am certain the old observation that there were 40 mills per county in the Carolinas and Georgias had given away to 40 stills per county. The only thing the South has done is change the letter M in mill to ST for stills. So what does this have to do with grits? The white liquor folks have the best mill corn and now are the best artisan millers in America. I'm going to repeat that. The white liquor folks have the best mill corn and are the best artisan millers in America. It is typical of the South that there is no legal way to proclaim and prove this. My experience that if the head of a Carolina and Georgia family is farming is over 70 years old and the family is listed at their local church for more than six generations, they have the best sorghum, biscuit, wheat, wine, jelly, honey, white lightning, aged moonshine, and if they don't have it, they can get it real quick. Most significantly, they have the best heirloom mill corn seed, but it's extremely difficult to get them to open up, obviously for any reason other than getting busted. These folks are passing on, and their children don't farm for a living. What I've been doing for the last 7 years is searching out bootlegging families and trying to get their seed transferred to a legal family to get it increased, to get it in seed archives. That's essentially what Anson Mills has been doing. Quote, we've grown this corn on our farm for as far back as anybody knows. Every year we harvest and hand break the seed corn, then crimp it up. At Christmas, we start hand shucking and shelling. We only shell the center 3 inches of the perfect ears for seed corn. The rest of it, we mill up, and, well, it just gets used up one way or another. Barbara and Douglas Bullock and Jerry Tyler, Lakeview, South Carolina, 1998. I have a Library of Congress picture over my desk at my office that clearly shows a Hopi standing next to a corn bush in 1880. The corn bushes, and notice I didn't say corn stalks, appear to be about 12 feet apart and seem to be part of a huge field as they disappear out to the horizon. Corn is separation sensitive. My genetic professional friends advise me that any corn seed given lots of separation will produce exactly 4 ears per plant. As corn is planted closer together, the ear count per plant goes down. In the 1950s, average corn yield per acre was about 50 bushels. Today, it's well over 300, and it's growing. My friend Marvin Mangus in Frizzle Flat Farm in Yale, Illinois, tells me that the genetic boys have developed an infinite density corn that is broadcast like grass seed and produces a cover crop of one-ear corn at 1,000 bushels an acre. To achieve soil nutrition to support this style of corn, farmers must blow nitrogen to support the farmers must blow nitrogen directly into the soil. They get lots of beautiful corn with little flavor. This corn is worth about $2.20 per bushel today, and there is no way a small farmer can make it in this environment. Okay, I'll wrap. what do I got? Ooh. Okay. Let's see.
I'm sorry, but I lied when I said you had to.
Okay. Okay, I got it. as I said earlier, millers work and listen. At this point, I'm involved with 9 farms hauling corn to and from the mill, and I'm lifting a lot of corn. I'm also a janitor at Ensign Mills, as John said, and that's what I do. But to keep things creative, we've started at Ensign Mills a historic ingredient resource center for professional chefs. We started it with parched corn products, and it now includes referrals to artisan items like hickory and cob ash powders, shagbark hickory syrup, and filet. Our mission is to get foodways right for professional chefs who need these resources. We do not charge our chefs or the producers for this service, and we are currently in about 20 test kitchen programs around the United States. We have about 300 restaurant clients right now at the mill, and they're all over the United States also, and some in Europe. This facet of my job is incredibly exciting. As to the future, I'm supposed to get back to work in my field sometime pretty quick here. And I appreciate the opportunity to come and present this to you, and thank you very much.